This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll hear from former State Representative Raymond Jensen on this week's Urban Congress for African American Males to be held in Baton Rouge. It's the third annual event hosted by Raymond Jensen. Jensen is also the former pastor of Star Hill Church, located about a block from where Alton Sterling died in July of 2016. We'll talk with Raymond Jensen about the aftermath of the decision to file no charges against Officer Blaine Salamone, who has lost his job with the Baton Rouge Police Department. Also, Elizabeth Crisp of The Advocate on her revelation last week that a state lawmaker, Dodie Horton of Houghton, was pushing fake news to make a point on a key piece of legislation. What's going on at the Capitol? And Governor John Bel Edwards hopes for a quick end to this session. Will it happen? We'll talk about it. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Hope you had a great weekend. And congratulations to Patrick Reed, the former U High star who won the Masters yesterday. Now regarded perhaps as the best golfer in the world, and he started right here in Baton Rouge and led UI to some state championships before going to the University of Georgia, where he was expelled, and then off to Augusta State, not far from Augusta National. And Patrick Reed is on top of the world as the champion of the most prestigious golf tournament in the world. In studio is Raymond Jensen, former state lawmaker, former Grambling football stalwart, and former pastor of Star Hill Church, as I noted in the open today, located literally about a block from where Alton Sterling was killed on July 5th, 2016. And we'll start there, but Raymond Jensen also has a major event, the third annual Urban Congress for African American Males, that's pertinent to the discussion about Sterling. It is this week, Saturday. And since we last talked with you, a decision came from the Attorney General, Jeff Landry. No charges against Blaine Salamone and none against Howie Lake. Certainly there was no expectation of charges against Lake, and many thought there would not be charges against Salamone, and there were not. Your thoughts?
If there had been charges filed against anyone by the Attorney General, it would have been one of the most stunning moments in Louisiana political history in the short term. I think that most people were resigned to the fact that the Attorney General would not file charges. The concern was, why did it take him so long to get to that public announcement of what was, for most people, I believe, a foregone conclusion?
877-217-5757 is your number. Locally, 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. And the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. It took about 10 months for Attorney General Landry to make his decision, and he did so without impaneling a grand jury. He's taken some heat for that. Is that a valid criticism?
In my opinion, yes. But not just in my opinion, but in the opinion of many who have practiced law, including a number of individuals who were considered to be very reputable prosecutors during that time, including Prim Burns and a couple of other individuals who are of note in our community for their prosecutorial background, who believed, after watching the videotape, that it is almost unconscionable that a group of citizens from this state did not have an opportunity to consider whether or no there should have been charges brought based upon the evidence.
Today's Advocate has a letter to the editor from Howard Tull, who's identified as a CPA in this community. He says that Baton Rouge Police Chief Murphy Paul was quoted correctly. Former Officer Blaine Salamone's attorneys will play it back to him. The chief was quoted as saying, if Alton Sterling was white and the officers were white, we probably wouldn't even be down here talking about it. Tull concludes, does that mean he would have not fired Salamone? So race is an issue. It's an issue in our society, and it's an issue in our community. How much was race a factor in this?
Jim, I would argue that you could have put a period after race is an issue, period. And one of the most debilitating parts of our culture and our history is our inability to have a real conversation about the impact of race, the impact of race on the way our community has developed, the way our community has been invested in, the way policing has historically taken place, the way a number of decisions and realities have unfolded in our community. It's impossible to have a meaningful conversation about how we begin to change things if we choose to ignore or push in a deep, dark corner, no pun intended, the matter of race.
Well, we're not going to advance unless we do something in addition to talking about it. What can be done?
Well, I last week sent out an open letter to the citizens of this community through a number of platforms, the Metromorphosis platform, the Urban Congress platform, wherein, Jim, I said that we need to do a few things. First of all, in order to heal, we have to acknowledge that there's a wound that has taken place. But secondarily, for those good the people who would like to see our community better, now is a time to move beyond talk and action. I offer, for those who are interested, the Urban Congress on African American Males as a platform for actively seeking to address many of the issues that impact and have meaning for African American males in this community. But if not the Urban Congress, then find something to do that begins to make our community a better place.
Well, it's a rather lengthy letter that Reverend Jetson wrote 6 days ago, and I can't read the whole thing, but it does say, "Most of my life has been lived in Baton Rouge. I've seen and experienced the good, the bad, and the ugly in these years. It's my sincere desire to be part of leaving a better Baton Rouge to the next generation, a Baton Rouge where black men are seen as assets and vital members of our community, a Baton Rouge where we are all productive, connected, healthy, and safe, a Baton Rouge where my neighborhood and zip code don't determine my access to opportunity and resources."
And I think, Jim, that's a current reality. Most of the images and messages that we hear about African-American males by mainstream media in our community are negative. I go through the Advocate on a regular basis, and the most volume of photos or messages about African-American males are in the police blotter.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I have addressed to the editor is, if someone is arrested, someone has been contained, they are no longer a threat to a community, what is gained by showing their picture to the community? And I think that there are subliminal messages in things like that. The opening of our news is so very often African-American men who are have in some way been accused of violating the law. And I'm not saying that those folks should not be dealt with by the appropriate legal system in our community. I am saying that there are a number of African-American males in our community who are doing extremely positive things and making a difference in our community, but rarely, if ever, are they the subject of mainstream media attention in our community.
Is it an issue of poverty as well? For example, I would imagine a white kid in Baton Rouge without means has a difficult time too, but what are the distinctions between being a poor white kid in Baton Rouge and a poor black kid?
Unfortunately, the poor white kid living near a poor black kid in our community is so very often convinced to believe that his interests are better served in some way by believing that he's even better than someone who is in an equal economic status. Poverty is a great driver of a number of negative life outcomes. We live in a state that is extremely high in the number of children and the number of families in our community who are impacted by poverty. But poverty is a huge mm-hmm. elephant to deal with. And I believe that it is important that we begin to break it down into pieces and begin to address it in a very strategic way, which is one of the things that I believe, Jim, is a benefit of the goals of the Urban Congress, that we have begun to look at issues one by one that have an impact on our community.
Well, Saturday at the Council on Aging Activity Center, 6958 Florida Boulevard, 9 o'clock, the Urban Congress will meet. It's the third annual event. It's a day-long event. In fact, it'll end by, I think, mid-afternoon.
We'll wrap up after lunch. Our second keynote is Coach Michael Taylor from the Houston area, who will wrap up our lunch. And after the keynote, he will do a book signing and book selling, and we'll be finished.
All right. And this starts at 9 o'clock, and it is open to the public.
It is. We would invite people to go to theurbancongress.com and register so that we will have an idea of how many people to plan for. I will say, Jim, and thank you for mentioning that, it is the third convening. This is our general convening. The calendar for the Urban Congress is basically in April through March. And so this is an opportunity for us to come together and say, here is what has happened mm-hmm. in this year, and to gain input from the people in the room in helping to chart a course for what should happen next.
We're visiting with Raymond Jetson, former state lawmaker, former Grambling football stalwart. He played for Eddie Robinson. Last time he was on this show, he talked about the influences that some of his mentors had on him, including Coach Rob. And mentors are quite appropriate and important, aren't they?
They are critical. And I will say that one of the good things, Jim, about coming on your show is that my college football career is at its high point.
Whenever I played with Doug Williams.
I was in the same air with Doug Williams. But thank you for the rumor of my skills when it came to college football. But Eddie Robinson's a great man.
Mm-hmm. He was a great man. Left quite a legacy, and we need more people like him.
Yes.
Black and white. We'll talk about that and how we come together. 877-217-5757. Back with more from Reverend Raymond Jetson after this brief pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Reverend Raymond Jetson is with us, pastor of Star Hill Church for many years and former state lawmaker, succeeded his father in the Louisiana House and served many years with distinction, and was occasionally a controversial member. And we're going to talk to him about a few different matters. And, of course, the city right now is still recuperating from almost 2 years of tumult following the Alton Sterling death. And Saturday, Raymond Jetson's third annual Urban Congress for African-American males, specifically in Baton Rouge, will be held at the Council on Aging Activity Center, 6955 Florida, 9 o'clock. And if you're interested, just show up, and you'll hear from Michael Taylor. Who's the other keynoter?
Roderick Miller, who actually served at the Chamber of Commerce here a few years ago, went to New Orleans, went to Detroit, and has now started his own international economic development consulting firm. And so Roderick will open us up. We also have Ahmad Mansour, who is a very, very talented facilitator from Oakland, who will be joining us.
I mentioned the necessity for mentors for young men of any race, but the first of your seven goals is to build upon existing African-American male leadership skills by focusing on parenting, family, mentoring, and community service.
And Jim, thank you for pointing that out. One of the things that I will say, as you see, there are seven goals to the Urban Congress. Each of those goals has a group of citizens from our community who are working toward advancing in these areas. And the group that worked around that first goal chose mentoring. They actually said, of these items that are listed, mentoring gives the opportunity for the greatest impact on our community. And they accomplished two things in this past year. One, they provided two opportunities for training around evidence-based practices for mentoring African-American boys. They trained more than provided training for more than 700 members of our community, which I think is a big impact. And secondly, they initiated the Mentoring BR, which is a network of more than 30 organizations who mentor largely African-American boys in some way in our community. And so that's an example of the work of the Urban Congress. But mentoring is absolutely critical.
And you noted last trip here that you had several mentors before you got to Grambling State University.
Yes,
mentors are critical at every stage of life, especially young people.
I would absolutely agree. I mean, I grew up in a household where my uncle, great uncle, who was like a grandfather, Gus Young, had just an unbelievable impact on me. My father, Louis Jetson, Charles Keel, who was the principal of my high school, Coach Roman Bates, who was my high school football coach, Coach Jack Shorter, who was not only my chemistry and physics teacher, but also a coach on the football team, who always had a challenging word about living up to my potential and being the best. But the good thing about it was when I messed up, and I did with a frequency that I'm not proud of, all of these men would call me to task, but in a loving way. And mm-hmm. then, of course, I mean, the reason I went to Grambling was because I wanted to know Eddie Robinson, and just to have an opportunity to be around him for a couple of years has left an imprint on my life that will be there forever.
Well, when you, quote, messed up without your support base, could the comeback have been possible?
I think it would have been very, very difficult because, like most young people, I made decisions that were not in my best interest in terms of advancing. And I would not have held myself accountable. I would not have been thoughtful about ways to really change my direction if it had not been for the people who were around me. And so I am a product of the wisdom of the village that was around me when I was a child.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was an only child. My father died when I was 8 years old. My mother raised me, and quite often she was away at work, and she left me to do pretty much what she thought I would do, and told me what to do, what not to do, and occasionally, like you, I didn't do the right thing, but I didn't get in some really, really bad trouble. But and I lived in a neighborhood where I had a support base. But if I had been in a neighborhood that was violent, where I had a chance of being killed, where drugs were readily accessible, as is the case for many African-American males in this community, what's it like for a young black kid on the streets today?
Absent, Jim, just a really strong support network and the opportunity to hear and see different messages and different opportunities, it's very, very challenging. Yet there are still a myriad of young black boys in our school system and in our communities who are excelling. But for many, it is very, very challenging, which is why it is so important for folks like me and others in our community to take the time to invest in the lives of young black boys in our community so that they have a real opportunity to not have their life stymied by what zip code they live in or other things which tend to be placed upon people as in some way designating their character and their capacity.
Well, it's a tough world in some places, no doubt about it. And the curious thing is that you mentioned the African Americans on the police blotter, and you see it in the Advocate on the crime page every day, usually page 2B.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, to white Baton Rouge, my guess is that many white people who even would identify themselves as progressives think that that's the norm for the African-American community. But most kids, the overwhelming majority, despite all these challenges, they still do okay, and they still obey the law, and they still have families and live productive lives. Why do we have this impression that the other side of Florida Boulevard is this zone where we dare not go if we're white, and they live a completely different kind of life than we do?
That is the prevailing narrative, Jim, and it has been a narrative that has been perpetuated in this community for years upon years upon years. And that is why one of the chief goals of the Urban Congress on African American Males is to change the narrative. until we hear different messages, until we see different images, we will continue to be shaped by the prevailing messages that we receive in our community. And overwhelmingly, when we talk about African-American males in our community, it is a deficit-based conversation. Here's what's wrong with black boys and men. And if we could only fix black boys and men in our community. Well, the reality is that black boys and men are impacted by systems and structures in our community. And we need to, without absolving people of their personal responsibility, also recognize that systems and structures have responsibilities also. And to the degree that the outcomes are as they are for African-American males, we need to also talk about how we address the systems and structures and the messages that we so comfortably send about black boys and men in Baton Rouge.
Your second goal, broaden access to and utilization of quality primary health, broaden access to and utilization of primary quality health, mental wellness, and addiction recovery services for African-American males. Are those assets available?
They are, excuse me, Jim, they are available, but in limited supplied. They are, because of the resource allocation, they are in many instances rationed in our community. And so even if you have someone who is seeking immediate access to recovery services, or someone who is seeking to live a life, a quality life, in overcoming a diagnosis of a mental illness, there are all kind of challenges and stigmas that are present in our community that make that very, very difficult. And one of the things, here's an example of that systems and structures. Without indicting the mm-hmm. systems and structures in place, how do we talk about the challenges and the stigmas that African-American males bring to bear in that? How do we discuss the huge issue with HIV and AIDS in our community without it being seen as if we are indicting the system?
877-217-5757. When we return with Reverend Jetson for another segment, we'll talk about the essential component of education on the quality of life for everybody, including African-American males. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757. The third annual Urban Congress of Baton Rouge for African-American males will be held Saturday, Council on Aging Activity Center, 6958 Ford at 9 o'clock. The host is Reverend Raymond Jetson, former state lawmaker. And also there are 500 individuals who are delegates who have donated their time and efforts to advance the work of the Congress. If you'd like to talk to Reverend Jetson, 877-217-5757 or 297-5633 talk at talklouisiana.org. 877-217-5757, and that's the number that Maxine Crump has called. Maxine, of course, has been a guest on this show, who heads Dialogue on Race as the president and CEO. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, Raymond. I wanted to ask Reverend Jetson to respond to the question that he was speaking of, the value of being able to talk about race. And your question was, okay, so talk, but shouldn't we go to action? And I wanted you, Ray, to address, would you be able to go straight to action now with the kind of rhetoric that I heard you describe and with the current narrative that we have in Baton Rouge and the Urban Congress needed to make that education for a narrative change more than just rushing off for an action as they did in the Oxbow incident, those of you who know, running off and having a posse lynch who they think is a problem, is what I think of when I think of just talking, of just acting, unless the talk has been cleared. And so I'd like you to talk about the value of having the proper narrative for action.
Thank you very much, Maxine, and I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the tremendous job that the Dialogue on Race does mm-hmm. in helping people to navigate what is for many a very, very challenging terrain in terms of conversation. It is impossible to just start doing without understanding the platform mm-hmm. from which we do. It's impossible. I oftentimes make the comment that healing requires the acknowledgement of a wound in order to mm-hmm. actually take place. And so we can't do if we're not willing to learn from each other and talk. As a matter of fact, one of the great negatives for many people of the Urban Congress is the very first year, Jim, we did nothing but talk, listen, and learn. Mm-hmm. We did not take action until the second year. Now, we had the luxury of being able to sustain ourselves while doing that, but that was the critical platform, paying attention to the narrative and the prevailing narratives in our community and beginning to speak to those issues.
Well, I think the action in large part needs to come from the white community. There are very few people like Chris Andrews, your ministerial colleague, who go into North Baton Rouge with Rebuilding Together Baton Rouge and work side by side with African Americans in areas that are in that zip code that is considered dangerous. They don't want to take the risk.
That is absolutely true for many. I will share with you, Jim, that the most repeated remark I get from people when they come to the Urban Congress monthly work group meeting, the most prevalent comment is people are surprised at the diversity of the people in that room. It's not just a room filled with black men, though that is the core of the conversation, but there are African-American females, there are white men, there are white females, there are Hispanics, there are just a diversity of people. And that's the kind of platform that we have to create to begin to address these issues, because they are greater than any single organization. They are greater than any single individual or any single race in our community to address. Nobody created this by themselves, and nobody will change it by themselves.
877-217-5757. Thank you, Maxine Crump, for calling and for your work as President and CEO of Dialogue on Race. And the point I was making is that at some point, action has to be coupled with the talk. Certainly, I believe in talk. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a radio show unless we
yes.
believe in the power of discourse. But here's a question, and a good one from Tracy at the Capitol, asking, we've talked about how white people perceive the other part of the city, north of Baton Rouge. How do black people perceive the other part of the city, south of Baton Rouge, those who are living north of Florida Boulevard?
Resource rich and the focus of the attention of all of the meaningful decision makers in our community. There is this sense on the part of many that there has been this disinvestment, this neglect of the northern part when it comes to catalytic and strategic investments in the community. And I think that that is the prevailing sentiment of many.
Hmm. Well, it means at some point we have to come together. And quite often, I suspect at your church, for example, there were very few white congregants.
Yes, sir. I mean, that oft-repeated comment that America, Louisiana, Baton Rouge, is at its most segregated at 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings. And that is the reality of our existence, unfortunately.
Well, number three on your list of goals is to expand the number of African-American boys entering kindergarten who are ready to learn and who are able to advance annually at or above their grade level. How important is education to this process?
Jim, if you will note, number three and number four are related to education.
Yeah, grow the graduation rates.
Yes, sir. And the numbers are tragic. When you consider the number of African-American boys who make it to the ninth grade and ultimately graduate from high school, the numbers become even more abysmal when we begin to look at college graduation. Our premise is that it begins at kindergarten, and that how ready young people are to learn when they show up for kindergarten is critical. And so a couple of things have happened as it relates to the kindergarten part a wonderfully talented group of people who've sat at the table working on this goal, created a family-friendly brochure that has been distributed and is being distributed in largely North Baton Rouge to parents of young kids on what it means to really have your mm-hmm. kid ready to go to kindergarten. We've also partnered with Cradle to K, which is the mayor's initiative around kindergarten readiness in our community. In the high school graduation rate, we are really excited because we have an MOU that was signed with the school board that was adopted by, with the school system that was adopted by the school board. We are working with them on their early warning system. So how do you know that young people are headed on a path where they won't, are likely to leave school early? As well as the discipline practices, which are disproportionately impacting African-American boys in our school systems.
877-217-5757 in our remaining time with Reverend Raymond Jetson. And Ali Baltazar says Gaston on College Drive is calling in. Gaston, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, Jim. Thank you, Reverend, for being there, and I'm so glad you touched on that topic. And I want to say something that might set some of you guys up. I think it's time we should end TOPS. You know, I know even one of my sons was a beneficiary of it, but you don't build a hospital from the roof down. You don't build a school that way, and you don't build a society that way. We should.
All right. Hang on, Gaston, but TOPS, is that a program? It's a program that largely helps white Louisianians, but does it help African Americans?
Some. I happen to be the father of a young man who started college on TOPS, and so I have received some of the benefit. But TOPS emerged with Mr. Taylor when I was in the legislature, and I, on a number of occasions, attempted to amend the TOPS legislation at that point to have some type of needs-based assignment to it, and to also recognize that not everyone performed exceptionally on standardized tests, and so to have some other way to look at the opportunity to participate. If we really wanted to grow our college graduation and to nurture the best and the brightest in our community, unfortunately, none of my efforts were successful, and so I think that TOPS helps a lot of kids. I mm-hmm. think that it is weighted in one direction and misses the opportunity to nurture a larger portion of our community.
And once again, that gets back to the discussion about talking about problems, because we have the same discussion going on today. And when did you leave the legislature?
I left the legislature in 1999.
So 19 years ago. And
yes.
we every year we have the same discussion on
yes,
this.
Sir.
Okay. Cultivate decarceration while advancing opportunities for successful reentry and restoration of full citizenship for African-American males. Right now at the legislature, there's a discussion, doesn't appear to be going anywhere, to undo the criminal justice reform. But there are those like Attorney General Landry and Senator Kennedy who say this was just an awful thing. Your thoughts?
If we consider that the United States is the largest source of incarceration in the world, and Louisiana is the largest incarcerator of people in the United States, then Louisiana is the incarceration capital of the world. I don't think that that is a moniker that we should wear as a badge of honor. And so we must strategically understand how we begin to retard the mass incarceration of people in our community who are overwhelmingly African-American male and increasingly female in our current culture. The effects of that, Jim, just bleed over into so many other areas of life. And so how do we strategically move from a policy base of mass incarceration to one of decarceration? And then the second thing that is critical that the state of Louisiana has done is focused on the successful return of people who have been incarcerated so that they don't go back and so that they have the systems and structures in place to be successful.
Well, thank you very much, Reverend Raymond Jetson. Always a pleasure. Good luck Saturday, the 3rd Urban Congress for African American Males at the Council on Aging Activity Center, 6955 Florida. Be there 9 o'clock if you wish.
Thank you very much, Jim.
This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us. Sally Baltazar and Becca Dill producing, and you're listening to Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. 877-217-5757 is your number, and locally 297-5633. We're joined by Elizabeth Crisp of The Advocate, who's been covering the Capitol, as she does on a regular basis, and, of course, other matters as well. And it's always a pleasure to share the microphone with you, Elizabeth.
Hey, Jim. How are you doing?
Doing well. And last week, you outed one of our state lawmakers as using fake news. What happened?
There was a hearing on a bill that looked to kind of expand the state's medical marijuana law that passed but hasn't quite yet been implemented yet. But it would add a couple of other ailments to the people who could qualify for medical marijuana. So I was listening and I was mostly curious if it would be easier to pass along medical marijuana legislation now that it's already kind of in the works here. I was only kind of partially following it, but I heard Representative Doty Horton from North Louisiana. There had been a whole bunch of people testifying in favor of this legislation. Several of them said that they, for various things, had been prescribed opioids. And they were saying that they wished that they could have access to medical marijuana instead, because you don't have to worry about the overdoses or addictions and all of that. And so Representative Horton came back with this story that she said proved that people do die of marijuana overdoses. And it was an article from a satirical website called The Daily Current that said on the first day of recreational legalization in Colorado, 37 people had died of overdoses of marijuana.
37 had died, and she reported this in a committee room?
Yes, and like I said, she was using that to refute testimony that had been given by members of the public, saying that they were coming up and they were lying. And, just it seems like all of this, the satirical publications or willfully fake news have, been in the media a lot. So immediately when I heard The Daily Current, I kind of perked up because I'm familiar with the site. And so I think my first tweet was just, wait, did she just quote a satirical website? And then so I just started Googling. I was like, 37 people died in Colorado of marijuana overdoses. And I came up
in
with
one
this,
day.
You know,
in one day.
Yeah, yeah, in one day. And so the first hit was Snopes.com, saying that this is false and it's being spread, but it was a satirical website. And the Daily Current doesn't even have that story up on their website anymore because it had kind of gone a little crazy and people were thinking that it was true. And so they just pulled it completely.
How did Representative Horton respond to your correction?
Well, at first, the hearing was still going on and there was still a lot of other testimony going on. So, I was tweeting this while she was still taking part in the hearing. So the first thing was I see a response from her where she tweeted at me and said that she had been given the information by a, quote, so-called trusted source, but she didn't feel like that being false negated the dangers of marijuana. I think she brought up, what about people who have car wrecks when they're high on marijuana or something like that. And one of my coworkers, so I retweeted that and I said, here's her response to spreading this, false news in a committee hearing. And one of my coworkers was like, did she, delete the tweet because it's not showing up anymore? So I went to look, and I had been blocked on Twitter.
She blocked you?
Yeah. So, and this wow. was immediately after replying to me, and I didn't do anything except for retweet her. So I wasn't totally sure what was going on. Afterward, later in the day, I had emailed her, and I just told her, I, as a reporter who covers the Capitol, I don't want there to be any sort of issues or hard feelings. I felt like I was just doing my job. And she wanted to talk about it then. And so we talked in person later in the day and she apologized. She said that it was somebody, on her staff who had, actually blocked me. She said that she felt bad about spreading misinformation during the hearing.
So has she unblocked you?
Yes, I have been on walks.
Okay, all right. Well, Representative Horton's not the first lawmaker to be caught in an embarrassment reporting fake news. I recall Congressman John Fleming from the same area of the state. On his mm-hmm. Facebook page, he had this big expose reporting that there was an abortion emporium opening.
Yeah, abortionplex or whatever.
Yeah, and it was one of those things that he was taking at face value, which was incorrect, and it shows you.
Yeah, I think that was from The Onion, actually.
Yeah, The Onion, another satirical site.
Yeah. But it's always one of those things that you have to watch in these hearings when legislators start, you know, citing various sources and statistics. I mean, without her even mentioning the Daily Current, that statistic of 37 people died in one day of a marijuana overdose, when I don't think that there's ever been any cases of a marijuana overdose that have been proven. And it, you know, to accept that 37 people died in Colorado of marijuana overdoses the day after legalization, then you would have to accept that there's nobody who was smoking marijuana beforehand. They were all just waiting for it to be legalized and then went gung-ho, I guess.
I would imagine if we had some physicians on here, too, they would say it would be very difficult to die of a marijuana overdose.
Yeah. there are a lot of times in hearings like that when sometimes things just don't completely ring true. And so I always try to figure out where the information is coming from. That one was pretty quick to come up with.
Well, was Representative Horton.
And then it kind of caught fire. My Twitter mentions are still kind of going crazy.
Yeah.
From people all over the country.
I know. Of course, this is an issue that has relevance across the great land of ours. But mm-hmm. has Representative Horton been chided by any of her colleagues?
Not as far as I know, not like publicly or anything like that. The legislation that was brought up in, that was actually Representative Ted James's bill. And when he got up on closing, he did say, you know, I want to respond to this. And I think she kind of motioned him, saying that she had already figured it out. And he said, okay, so you figured out you were quoting a joke website.
Right.
And just kind of left it at that, you know, and it wasn't a real chiding. It was more of a, you know, let's just get the record straight here.
Well, Representative James's bill, it did clear committee, didn't it?
It did. Yeah, it did. And later in the day, there was another medical marijuana bill that was up on the House floor that dealt with children with certain autism spectrum disorders, and it passed through the House chamber and is heading to the Senate now. So what I was watching for was, does it seem like some of this medical marijuana legislation has a bit more traction now that the first big component of it has gone through? And it does at least appear that that may be the case.
Well, Representative James's bill, I think it includes chronic pain as one of the one of the items that would allow somebody to have medicinal marijuana. Now, chronic pain, does that mean this opens the gate to anybody who says, hey, I've got a backache, I need some pot? Does this open the gate for them to have access to marijuana?
It's pretty tightly confined in that legislation. And, you know, it would still have to be only certain doctors would be able to prescribe, and because it just expands on the disorders in the current law. So it would still have to go through the process, which they tailored very narrowly. You know, it's only the cannabis oils and things like that. There's not smokable marijuana. That was originally part of Representative James's tweaking, was he was going to add where you could have, you know, marijuana that could be smoked, or also infused edibles, but those were taken out before that left committee.
All right, so where does it go? Do you think it has a chance?
After this many sessions and everything in just the past couple years, I try to not predict what they're going to do over here. But like I said, it does seem to be a little bit easier for them to vote for some of this now.
And the governor is trying to get this session over with as quickly as possible. Do you think he'll be successful?
Yeah. So I spoke to him about this the other day, and he said that the last thing that he heard from the House Speaker was, you know, their original target was he had hoped that they could finish up by May 14th. The Speaker told him that it probably couldn't be the 14th, maybe more like the 18th to 20th range would be more realistic. I feel like if we're already 3 weeks in and having to push back the date, that probably doesn't bode well.
Well, Elizabeth Crisp, we commend you on your work, and thanks for joining us today, and we'll let you get back to work. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye. And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, and talk about our world at large. For Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill, we hope you have a great week, and hope it's off to a great start. Again, congratulations to Patrick Reed of U High, who is the Masters champion of 2018. Until tomorrow, thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.